This is Crossroads, the Get Religion podcast.
Unless it is airstrikes or terrorist bombings or other acts of terror, the media is generally pretty sensitive about how it deals with Islam. Now, if the word isn't terrorism but blasphemy, how does the media write about that story? There is a story about a Pakistani Christian woman who was charged with blasphemy and faced a possible death penalty. She has been acquitted, and already there is news of rioting in the streets. Question remains, is she safe, even though she may be legally free? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So, Asia Bibi, is she safe now that she's free?
Well, this is a really ironic part of this whole story, in that her family has been in hiding now, you know, for multiple years to try to preserve their safety. But simply stated, more people are killed after being accused of blasphemy when they're outside the jails than when they're inside. So you could make a case that even though she was suffering abuse at the hands of other prisoners, you could make a case that she was safer in the jail than she is now that she's been released. I've been looking at stories to try to find out what's being done to protect her. But there's the other irony. Never forget that back at an earlier stage in this case, you had a prominent politician, a governor of one of the regions there involved in the case, spoke out on behalf of Asia Bibi. Or Asaya. I'm not sure if it's Asia or Asaya because I haven't heard it pronounced. Someone spoke out on her behalf, and this governor was then assassinated by his own bodyguard. So at this point, it's safe to ask, who can protect her? You know, if police and bodyguards are just as dangerous as a mob, and a mob is what you find once you're outside the jail, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which she isn't at tremendous risk in these first couple of days after her release. We have several nations who have offered her asylum. But stop and think about this for a second. How does she get out of Pakistan without going through the official mechanisms of the state, which probably mean tremendous numbers of police and armed guards, right? I mean, do you try to sneak her out over the border in a vehicle? Do you try to fly her out, which would mean moving her through very public places to get her out of an airport? What's the scenario here under which this woman and her family get to either live in Pakistan or leave Pakistan under safety? It's really, I mean, everybody's celebrating this verdict. And this acquittal is very unusual. It was very interestingly worded. And I was pleased with the press coverage that noted not just the acquittal, but noticed that, I mean, predicted that the big story was actually going to be what happened in terms of demonstrations, rioting, etc., upon her release, in a reaction to the acquittal. So right now, we all need to be watching the newspapers and some of the television channels. BBC, I think, would be safe to watch. CNN had an excellent report, and so did National Public Radio. So there are some places we can watch and listen to right now to try to find out what happens next.
Refresh us on the facts. What did Asia Bibi do that ended up with her being charged with blasphemy. And you're going to have to explain the kind of term of art there in the, is in Islamic law. And then eventually, if I'm not mistaken, at least threatened with the potential of a death penalty.
Right. Well, in her case, let's start at the beginning. She lives in a rural area. She was a laborer, a farm laborer. Was the only job she had. And one day, while in the field laboring on a hot day, people disagree on whether she was asked to fetch water for the other workers, all of them Muslims. There are only three Christian families in her village, is the figure I've seen over and over. She's asked or ordered to retrieve a water bucket. At that point, the next detail that isn't certain is whether she just offered them the bucket or whether she offered them something in a dipper. But either way, some Muslim laborers said, a Christian has already drunk from this bucket or dipper, and thus it is unclean, and began yelling at her and abusing her. Even though in some tellings of this story, and once again, the factual details depend on the local authorities, and that's very much up for grabs. There's a confrontation. People begin yelling. Now, what she said next is also under dispute. Everybody agrees there was an argument, but the court, part of its ruling was that they basically decided that they couldn't know for sure what happened in this confrontation. One of the quotes attributed to her, a heated word, I'll read a piece of a coverage from the Telegraph. Heated words were then exchanged, during which Mrs. Beebe is alleged to have told her neighbors, Jesus Christ died on the cross for the sins of mankind. What did your prophet Muhammad ever do to save mankind? Now, at this point, making disparaging remarks against the prophet is the essence of blasphemy as it's defined under the form of Sharia law found in Pakistan. Now, we need to stop here for just a moment and stress something very important in case our listeners don't know, that since these blasphemy laws went into their current form in 1987, I believe that is the year, the statistics I'm seeing quoted is that 633 Muslims, 494 Ahmadi Muslims, which of course is kind of a splinter group of Islam that regular Muslims consider to be heretics, 187 Christians, and 21 Hindus have been charged under these blasphemy laws. So it's important for listeners to realize that these laws are used more often to keep progressive or unconventional Muslims under control than they are to persecute the very small Christian minorities in Pakistan. So blasphemy is also not a concept that is exclusive to Islam. There are interesting blasphemy laws that remain in effect in other parts of the world. And, you know, when I think of a nation in which there are more conflicts over what you can say and do and wear in public, if you wanted to think of it this way, you could argue that France has its own forms of blasphemy laws against the secular religion of France. So I think listeners need to understand that this is definitely a Muslim situation in Pakistan, but it's something that is being used against all kinds of people, not just Christians.
So let's deal with a couple aspects here of the coverage, starting with perhaps the more weighty. In your perusal of the coverage, what factor has the United States relationship with Pakistan played? It sounds to me like that would be a major angle here, given the fact that Pakistan is a non-NATO ally and recipient, right, of lots and lots of U.S. largesse.
Well, I think it's important to realize that this has been going on for 7, 8, 9 years, which means it precedes this administration, which means whatever is going on, the State Department has probably been involved behind the scenes for a long time. The government of Pakistan and the military of Pakistan, of course, those are two distinct groups of people, but very closely entwined. I think it's really interesting that a lot of people were shocked that you got a court that basically said, ironically quoting Shakespeare, "This looks more like this woman has been sinned against than that she has done any sinning." The other thing that I pointed out in my piece at Get Religion is I've wondered to what degree has the UN or any international agencies played a role, because there's no question that this kind of a blasphemy law situation violates the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the UN. Now, of course, lots of nations violate it, from Saudi Arabia and others in the Muslim world. It's not uncommon to see this violated, but I've wondered if behind the scenes, Pakistan gets aid from a lot of different places, and a lot of different NGOs, non-government groups, are active in Pakistan in terms of aid. Depending on what happens next, this could be a step forward in terms of Pakistan being able to some degree, moderate the views of its population. There's no question that these blasphemy laws are very, very popular with a large part of the Pakistani population. I've seen figures approaching 60. But if it's 60 who are in favor of these laws, 40 is not an insignificant part of the population. And most of the time when you look at blasphemy situations in a nation like Egypt, and I don't know the situation in Pakistan as well in terms of talking to people who study it, in Egypt, the popularity of these kinds of laws goes up sharply the further you get outside of urban areas. In rural Egypt, and I would assume in rural Pakistan, where this story unfolded, these laws are much more popular. Most of the aid is being negotiated and handled by government officials in the major cities. So I think to some degree, Pakistan is who faces the decision right now. The government of Pakistan, to what degree are they going to either change these laws, undercut these laws, or deal with the consequences in terms of their own citizens revolting? There's a tremendous amount of tension right now in that nation involving secondary political parties which radically support the blasphemy laws. And these political parties are not going away. And so you have structures within the Pakistani government on both sides of this issue. But right now, what I'm reading within the government, it appears to be a minority. But I have to admit, I don't know the fine points of that in their parliamentary system.
Terry, let's talk a little bit about the media coverage, starting with the confusing and working toward the things you were commending. You found a particular turn of phrase in the Washington Post coverage, and I did too. I just couldn't figure out what they were trying to say. What did they write, and what was so confusing about it?
Well, as always, people use political language. You know, I've said it probably 1,000 times, you know, in our talks over the years. Journalism tends to assume that politics is real and religion is not so real. And especially when you're dealing with something like this, where politics is legitimately involved and you're in a land where there is no separation of mosque and state, to say the least. I mean, they are attempting to create a form of theocracy in Pakistan. The issue is to what degree will the rule of law and parliamentary things be involved in this. So when you use left and right, conservative and liberal, what do those terms mean? We'll get to that in just a second. But what intrigued me was the phrase in a Washington Post story, "Bibi's case ignited acute tension between the increasingly aggressive far right anti-blasphemy movement and groups supporting leniency. Now, leniency is, let's take the second half of that equation. Leniency could mean that you accept the blasphemy laws, but that you would just like to see them used differently. I mean, wouldn't that be how you might interpret leniency?
Yeah, I would say leniency is actually what was demonstrated, at least from their perspective, by this three-judge council.
But it didn't overturn the laws.
No.
That's my point. So then, once I read that, I went, huh? I looked back at the earlier phrase. So the far right anti-blasphemy movement. Now, when I say the words anti-blasphemy to you, what do you think that means?
Well, in the context of this story, it sounded like it was, my first impression was someone who would be against the blasphemy laws that got this woman tossed in jail.
Someone who is opposed to the concept of blasphemy. Right. And that's how I interpreted. But then, right in front of that little train wreck is aggressively far right. Okay, well, now we get to the left and the right. When you go around the world, and especially when you take this on in the context of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, this is one of those cases where religious liberty and freedom of the conscience on matters of religion, conversion, the ability to state your religious beliefs, this is liberal in the truest sense of that word in terms of political theory and political thought and on the global scene. Being in favor of religious liberty is liberal. Thus, it didn't make any sense to have aggressive far-right people being in favor of religious liberty and opposing blasphemy. Because in this case, far right would mean defending the blasphemy laws within the context of conserving, I guess right wing means conserving, the laws of Pakistan. So then I went, okay, well, in this case, they must be saying anti-blasphemy means the anti-blasphemy movement is a movement against people who are committing blasphemy. It can be read either way, can it?
Yes.
I mean, so out of all of the language that I read in a blitz in an hour after this came out, this struck me as one of the strangest combinations of political language that I saw anywhere. I think what they're trying to say is one group of people doesn't want the blasphemy laws to continue and wants people to have some degree of freedom within Pakistan, and the other is in favor of the blasphemy laws and wants to see them defended and even strengthened or used to their legal extent, which includes the death penalty. But that phrase, you know, let me just read that again and listen to my head spinning as I read this. Bibi's case ignited acute tension between the increasingly aggressive far-right anti-blasphemy movement and groups supporting leniency. Maybe what they're trying to say is the increasingly aggressive far-right defenders of radical forms of Sharia law or defenders of radical aggressive use of the blasphemy laws and those who oppose the laws or oppose their use. I mean, I'm trying to think of different ways to say this. A lot of other stories really had cleaner language simply by talking about it more in terms of religion and just simply saying those who favor the blasphemy laws and those who oppose them. Now, isn't that clear?
Yes.
So thus, those who oppose them are much more likely to be cheering for the acquittal of Asiyah Bibi, whereas the people who are now rioting in the streets and marching in favor of use of the laws, including against her, wanting her to hang, that would be people who are in favor of the blasphemy laws. So, you know, when in doubt, describe religious arguments in terms of religious language. That might be one of the things we can take away from this.
So where did you find the best coverage, in your estimation, of this story?
Well, there was an excellent kind of series of backgrounder information pieces at the BBC. Now, you would expect that, because BBC is so strong on international coverage, and especially in the wider world that used to be a part of England's reach. So Pakistan, being territory that once was part of India, are in that realm. You would expect strong BBC coverage, and I saw it there. I was very pleased, frankly, with the depth of the coverage at National Public Radio, and then was surprised by the depth of the coverage, especially on short notice, at CNN. They dedicated quite a bit of attention, at least online, to this. Now, I don't watch much television news these days. I prefer to read transcripts of speeches and whatever during the Trump era, and we're not going to get into a discussion of that. That's just my own personal lifestyle choice, okay? What I found lacking in a lot of the coverage was not many people were all that interested in this woman herself. For she was consistently just referred to as a Christian, as a Christian, as a Christian. And then you wonder why the Pope is speaking out so strongly on her case.
He's calling her a martyr.
Yeah, strong language. And not just one Pope, but the, you know, Benedict as well. So yes, this woman is apparently a Roman Catholic. And that would be a nice detail, because that's not exactly a minor player on the global scene at the level of aid dollars as well. I mean, if you want consistent aid for the poor and for distressed sections of your country, ticking off the Vatican is probably not something you'd want to do. So I wanted to know more about her, and I wanted to know more, frankly, about her family and the incident itself. But, you know, the more I thought about that, maybe it's good that we don't know all that much about her family right now. That may be telling us that they have been pretty effectively hidden. Now, when they got outside the country a year or so ago, you saw quite a few interviews where members of her family were able to speak on the record, knowing that they were outside of Pakistan. So I would, you know, in the days ahead, when the issue that we all have to keep our eye on is she safe? And what is going to happen to her? That's the family and her personal location and safety and her whereabouts. And who is guarding her when you can't trust the guards? Isn't that a disturbing thought? In other words, how would you try to guarantee your safety if you knew the police wanted you dead? And I'm not saying that all Pakistani police want her dead, but the odds are pretty good that some of them are drawn from sectors of the society that favor the blasphemy laws. I mean, when you can gun down a governor and you are in his own security detail, that says a lot. That doesn't make you feel very good about the ability to keep someone safe in Pakistan. And then the murderer was put on trial, was convicted, and was executed. And now the tomb of the man who murdered that governor who came out in support of Mrs. Bibi, that tomb is now a shrine. And people from Pakistan are making pilgrimages to, I believe, the appropriate gesture. When he came out of one part of his trial, he was showered with rose petals by the crowds. And I would assume that's similar to what's happening at his shrine now. That's pretty serious symbolism that makes you worry about this woman now just as much now as we did when she was behind bars.
We've only got a few minutes here, Terry, but you mentioned that the government and the military are two kind of different problems in Pakistan. But In the coverage that you saw, how was the Pakistani government described? Was it described as under the influence of radical Islam? Did any of those kind of terms appear there in the coverage that you perused? We got about a minute and a half.
Yeah. Simply stated, it's just too complex right now to sum it up one simple way. It's very apparent. Like I said, there are actual political parties that have rallied around, they almost owe their existence to the blasphemy laws and efforts to defend them. Now, this is not a majority party at this point, or all kinds of different things would be happening. But you'd have to say that within the government, you have divisions. Think of it this way. There's a reason that Osama bin Laden was able to hide safely inside the borders of Pakistan for so long. There were elements within the military and elements even within the Pakistani secret police and their secret service. They knew he was there. And they're cooperating with America and accepting aid and all these other things. And they know Osama bin Laden is holed up in Pakistan. So, I mean, if that isn't a living symbol of how complex things are within their government and within the various levels of security in that country, I can't think of a stronger image.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.